versus Daniel Rapay. Good morning.
May it please the court. This case presents the court with an opportunity to re-examine the issue of what amounts to reasonable time to comply with the registration obligations of SORNA. As in Dixon, that is the critical question here. When does that duty arise? It's interesting to compare some of the facts in Dixon to the case that is before the court today. In the Dixon case, the charged dates in the indictment were from February 28th through April the 5th. April the 5th is 18 days after the outermost date charged by the government in the indictment against Mr. Rapay. If, as the government seems to be suggesting in its papers, you could simply blue line what would be reasonable dates, why then didn't the court do that before in Dixon? Because clearly there were weeks encompassed in that charged period that go beyond the charged period in this case. It was not appropriate then. It is not appropriate now. You just can't fudge on a conviction under this law. And it is noteworthy to focus on the time period that is at issue truly in this appeal. The government essentially accepts that even if their worldview applied, the first day that Mr. Rapay would be obliged to have registered was Monday, the Monday after the federal regulation was enacted and became effective. That was the 5th of March. The very first day charged in the indictment is the next day, the 6th of March. They continue on through the 18th, but let us not forget, Mr. Rapay was arrested on the 16th. So the real period of time where Mr. Rapay was arguably able to control his actions runs from Tuesday, the 6th of March, through Thursday, the 15th. We're talking 10 calendar days. And what he was subjected to, ultimately, and the judgment of conviction that was imposed, exposed him to a year of imprisonment for each one of those days.
Isn't there a possibility of harmless error here? Isn't it distinguishable from Dixon on the ground that he did, in fact, not register until the 19th, which is a lot longer than the 3 days that we're talking about initially.
Judge Cudahy, that's why.
Does that make these particular circumstances, does that raise the possibility of harmless error?
I do not believe so, Your Honor, and that's why I opened up with comparing the alleged period of noncompliance in Dixon with what we have here. Because if that were true, why then could the court not then, on stipulated facts in Dixon, stipulated facts on a bench trial, say, 3 days isn't enough, 5 days isn't enough, 10 days is plenty. And clearly you had stipulated that you hadn't registered until the outermost bounds of that alleged period. It was stipulated to April the 5th. That was not acceptable to the court, and I don't think it should be acceptable here.
Speaking about harmless error, though, Dixon, the defendants in Dixon, I understand, were only charged with one count. And here, Mr. Rapay is convicted on four counts, and three of them are not challenged on this appeal, and in one he received a concurrent sentence. All of them were concurrent sentences, but the one that's not challenged is the same length as the one he received here. So as a practical matter, what happens here if you were to win? I mean, isn't it
The phrase,
the sentence isn't going to be changed, is it?
Judge Evans, the phrase Pyrrhic victory comes to mind, but the reality is under precedent he would be entitled to make his pitch to the district court for resentencing. And whether that might affect, for example, the evidence that is brought in and considered as germane to the three counts upon which he was convicted is something I think that is certainly plausible, and he should have that opportunity to do so. Fundamentally, the notion of this kind of criminal liability being imposed on such a immediate short-term basis is something that should give all of us a moment to pause.
We had an obligation to register since 1996 in Illinois, and you never did that, right?
That is not being challenged, Your Honor. And to be sure, it was the government's position that we really don't need to offer evidence proof of when he didn't register during the charge period, because he just didn't register, period. And frankly, if you look at the federal regulation that the Attorney General put on the books, 28 CFR section 72.3, it's bereft of any dates. You could go to example 2 and look at the example 2. It has no dates, no guidance whatsoever. In fact, if you take it to its logical extreme, example 2, you could have been arrested before the Attorney General's rule became effective and be considered to be in violation of SORNA. That would be the literal reading of example 2. There was insufficient guidance, insufficient time provided for people to modify their activity to be able to avoid the kind of criminal liability, severe criminal liability, that is layered on top of state court criminal liability, which did apply in this case. Mr. Rappe went from the DuPage County prison right into the federal correctional custody of the government after spending 5 months there. So it's not as if he was going to evade any kind of criminal penalty for his conduct. He indeed was punished. It's the notion for ramping up and this incredible multiplier that exists that is unsettling, and in this case, appellant contends, fundamentally unfair. Those are the points I wanted to make on my opening remarks. I'll reserve any additional time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. McFadden.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Christopher McFadden on behalf of the United States. Ever since 1996, the defendant was required to register under Illinois state law. For 8 years, between 1999 and March 19th of 07, he completely failed to do so. In the middle of those 8 years, in February of 2006, the federal registration law known as SORNA went into effect.
I thought it was 2007.
The act was passed in July of 2006.
The regulation was passed in 2007.
Correct, Judge.
That made that statute applicable to someone in his position.
Correct. February 28th of 2007. We charged in the indictment and we proved at trial that he failed to register from March 6th all the way through and including March 18th of 2007. Now, absolutely, that was a reasonable time period. There was overwhelming evidence, first of all, this defendant never was going to register ever. There were documents.
Well,
there were tests.
Wait a second. If 30-some odd days in Dixon was not reasonable, how is whatever it is, 16 or 19 days in this case, reasonable?
A couple of reasons why it's reasonable. First of all, I don't think it's the right characterization to say 30 days in Dixon was not reasonable. What we have, and if we look, as I read the Dixon opinion on page 586, there was no evidence in the record at all as to when this person failed to register. The Dixon opinion talks about how there was an indictment, but that this is only a charge and that there is no evidence. In this case, we put in, and the concern in Dixon in reversing his conviction was he could have been prosecuted for not registering on February 28th, which is day zero. And the court said that's not reasonable to prosecute somebody on the very first day. But there was no reason for the court to talk about what might happen in a situation where somebody had a week or something like that, because there was no case presented in Dixon where somebody had a week. The one person
was victim about what a reasonable time is. It's not just a week, and it's not just, I've forgotten what the full statement is, but pretty open-ended.
I agree, but I also agree with what you said, Judge Cadahy. It's dicta. One person could have been prosecuted on day one. The other person had not registered 5 months later. Clearly, 5 months is reasonable. Clearly, day one is not reasonable. But even if you place weight on that, it's significant in this case that in our jury instructions, in the evidence, and in our closing arguments, we presented evidence that he was not registered up to 19 calendar days or 13 business days after the AG issued those regulations. That's more than 2.5 times. If we're looking at calendar days, it's 2.5 times the number of calendar days. If we're looking at business days, it's 4 times the number of business days that Congress expressly authorized in the statute. And
well,
given
the statute presupposes, I think, that the duty, the 3-day duty, starts to run at the time of conviction and sentencing, right? And the offender is typically given a warning about the duty to register?
The statute said, basically, you're right. Yes, the statute said for people who are in custody now, you have 3 business days of when you get out. It was the AG who then said the statute applies to people regardless of when their conviction took place. So the 3-business-day grace period begins when the AG issued the regulation on February 28th of 07.
Right. My point, though, is that the 3-day window presupposes a state of affairs where the defendant is going to be told he has to register in 3 days. Right? And so applying that standard of reasonableness here, which it seems to me you're trying to do, or at least that's part of what your argument is here, that some multiplier of 3 days is going to be reasonable, but that's not premised on the same sort of state of affairs where the offender is going to be told he has to register. He has to acquire that knowledge on his own by virtue of the regulation making an otherwise inapplicable statute applicable to him.
That seems to call for a
different standard of reasonableness, is my point.
Okay. And I see what you're saying. And he did not get a written notice on February 28th that said SORNA applies to him. But usually, people have no idea that these laws are out there. Congress gave a grace period in this case of 3 business days. And the evidence showed, going back, what we argued at trial, and I think the way that SORNA is best interpreted is, SORNA makes it a federal crime if you knowingly fail to do what state law requires you to do, provided that you then travel in interstate commerce.
If you're registered under a state registration system, is the state obligated, or does the state inform you of your obligations under SORNA? I mean, how do you know? Somebody gets convicted in the Milwaukee County Circuit Court of some crime, and now they have to register. So they're registered, and they're floating along, and all of a sudden this federal law gets passed. How does somebody know that they have to go down to the police station and fill out a form to satisfy the federal law? How do they know that?
As part of the Adam Walsh Act going forward, each state is supposed to come into compliance with the provisions of the federal act, and one of those provisions going forward.
This is real easy going forward. If somebody gets convicted, now they're told that they have to register, and the probation department would assist them in doing that. But I'm talking about somebody who's already serving, maybe on parole, maybe released a long time ago from probationary supervision, but they have a registration with the state. How do they know about this federal law and that they have to comply with it?
The best way I can answer it, I can't speak for how it would work in Wisconsin. In Illinois, when somebody is in prison, for example, this defendant, when he was registered, he gets that card that says, here are all your duties under Illinois law. So when he registered in 2007, he got a card like that. When he last registered in 1999, he got a card like that, setting out his obligations under Illinois state law. All that SORNA says is that if you fail to comply with Illinois state law, then you're also committing a federal violation. So basically, there's been no dispute here. If he had complied with Illinois state law, he would have been in compliance with SORNA on the days of the indictment in this case. The problem was he didn't do what he was supposed to do under Illinois law, and then traveling in interstate commerce had exposed him to additional penalties under SORNA. But really, Judge, how do you know about SORNA, or how would somebody like him have known about SORNA? Really, all he had to know was, what's he have to do under Illinois law? And he definitely knew what he had to do under Illinois law. But then once SORNA went into effect, it could expose him to penalties under that as well.
So it's not really a federal registration requirement?
Not at this the way we argued it at trial, and I was trying to answer this, but it's, the statute is a little bit complicated because the Adam Walsh Act gave states a certain amount of time to come into full compliance with the Act. Eventually, all the 50 states are going to have to do a bunch of different things to be in full compliance with the Adam Walsh Act. Right now, we're in a period where only one or two states have done that. So during this time period, goes back to what I had said earlier, what you need to do is comply whatever, what you need to comply with whatever it is that your state law requires you to do. And if you do not, and you travel in interstate commerce, you could be convicted under the federal law, as well as if you've done something improper under the state law.
Or failure to register with the state, then? Excuse me. The gravamen of the offense is the failure to register with the state.
Sorna says you need to register in the jurisdiction where you live, reside, blah, blah, blah. He had never done that. Since he had knowingly failed to do that, he was also not in compliance with SORNA once he traveled in interstate commerce.
Wasn't he convicted of a jury trial on the assumption that he was required to register in 2006, isn't that right?
No. Let me explain why. I think
let me complete the question. Anyway. You can respond to that, but if that is the case, shouldn't he be retried with a jury instruction indicating that he was supposed to register after February 28th? And isn't it a jury question what a reasonable time thereafter is?
I'll try to answer those questions in the order that they came, Judge. There was a jury instruction that said the government had to prove that he failed to register from March 6th, 2007 through March 18th of 2007. So the jury was told the express dates when we had to prove that he was out of compliance, beginning on March 6th of 2007. And that's because our view always was that there was this minimal grace period, and that then if he was out of compliance after that, he could only be convicted if he was out of compliance after that grace period. In terms of whether there should... So I don't think there was any problem with the jury instruction or how we argued it in our closing arguments or how it was presented at any point. And in fact, if you look at page 957 and 958 of the trial transcripts, we make that same point again. I kind of lost what the other question was, Judge. I'm sorry. But
well, I just say, isn't it a jury question what a reasonable time is in that context?
I don't believe it is, Judge. Questions like this as to, you know, whether somebody got due process or whether the statute complied with, you know, the ex post facto clause, those are questions of constitutional law. And I think that those need to be resolved by the court ahead of time. And the court can say, look, here are the dates that they're alleging in the indictment. Is the government giving this person a reasonable amount of time here? I think the court has to make that decision as a matter of law. Then it becomes for the jury to decide, just as they were instructed here, you know, on those dates, did we prove that he was out of compliance on those particular dates? Because I think that's the only way for there to be uniformity and consistency, particularly on a matter of constitutional law like that. Again, Your Honors, I see that the red light is on. We've cited a lot of precedent that says that when Congress creates a grace period, it's entitled to the greatest deference from the courts, and we'd ask you to apply deference in this case. We're not focusing on the March 6th date. We're focusing on the March 18th date, which, again, was 18 days after the statute, after the grace period began, 13 calendar days. It was a simple and straightforward rule. It just said, go to the police department, fill out a two-page form, do the same things that you've been required to do for the last 8 years that you've deliberately failed to do. If he had done that, there would have been no problem in this case. And we think that his conviction and his sentence should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lefebvre, 2 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I agree with Mr. McFadden. This is a complicated law. And the idea that compliance and the periods that are at issue is clear is, I think, manifestly shown to be untrue in this case. The charged conduct included time when this individual was in prison. Under the law, when you're in custody, you don't have an obligation to register. So we know that those days are out of the picture, and so you have to back the day up even further. It wasn't reasonable time. Congress did not express an intent for a grace period. They expressed an intent for a compliance period. They also expressed an intent that the Attorney General provide clear regulatory requirements as to whether or not this would apply to individuals convicted before the enaction of SORNA. That didn't happen for 7 months. I don't think there were people out there poring over the Federal Register trying to comb through this, and if they had, I suspect if they'd read the AG's rule, they would have been left uncertain as to what their action should be, because there's nothing in there with regard to when the registration obligation applies, and we know it can apply before the AG's regulation came into effect. And we also know that the lower court erred on a legal question, because the lower court held the Attorney General's interim rule had no bearing on his regulations. That is not true. That is absolutely inconsistent with Knox. And because that ruling cascaded throughout the trial, it infected fatally count four, and that count should be reversed. And that's what we asked the court to do, and to remand this case for resentencing. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And our thanks to both counsel. Mr. Lefebvre, you were appointed on this case, I understand?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. You have the thanks of the court for your service to your client and to the court. The case is taken under advisement.